Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Alan First, whose latest novel is The Foreign Correspondent. Previous novel, Dark Voyage. This is, I think, the ninth in a series of books, kind of literary spy thrillers set in and around World War II. Very atmospheric books. Alan First, before we talk about Foreign Correspondent, I've interviewed you a couple of times before. I didn't interview you for your last book, which was Dark Voyage, so I'd like to talk a little about Dark Voyage first. That one is set on a ship in shipping lanes during World War II and features a Dutch captain on a ship, a Dutch merchant ship that's being disguised as a Spanish ship as it wends its way through the Mediterranean and the North Sea. What brought you to write about shipping? I mean, it may be natural that you're going to move to the seas at some point.
Well, when you write about the period, I try to write about the things that happened during the period, about the people who worked during the period, and about the people who became involved in resistance, anti-fascist undergrounds of one kind or another. And you have to look at tramp freighters and the part they played in Europe. I think if I can look at this, the epigraph of this book says it all. In the first 19 months of European war, from September 1939 to March of 1941, the island nation of Britain and her allies lost to U-boat, air, and sea attack, to mines and maritime disaster, 1,596 merchant vessels. That was about 25% of all the merchant vessels in the world. If the German blockade, U-boat blockade, had continued, that would have been the end of Britain. They wouldn't have been able to fight on. There would be, you know, they'd be speaking German there today or whatever, you know. That's why I felt I had to do it. And if you have a tramp freighter, you have to have a Dutch captain, since most of them did have Dutch captains. Holland was an occupied country, so they can't be operating as a Dutch freighter, so they operate as a neutral Spanish freighter. There are books which give the histories of all the tramp freighters in the world. Can you believe that? As of 1939?
Was the Nordendam, was that based on a specific real freighter?
No, based on a bunch of stories about freighters that operated for the British during that period. In the book, this freighter does essentially what tramp freighters did. They were basically disguised troop ships, or they did courier duty of very complicated kinds, or they did secret, as they do at the end of Dark Voyage, they do secret shipping.
This was pretty common then. I mean, when you were looking through your histories, you saw several of these.
It wasn't so very common as I thought it was. It turned out not to be. I got to read a lot of British naval intelligence history, which is fabulous, which I'd never read before, which is extremely interesting. It's like reading about a whole different war. Because I had, you know, I already wrote about the French resistance and this and that and the other, so this is yet a new story.
And specifically, how did you stumble on the idea that this was going to be the book you were going to write at that time?
I have a friend that I went to high school with who's now a partner in a maritime law firm in New York. And we were talking one day about my book, Blood of Victory. And he said, I read Blood of Victory. I really enjoyed it. By the way, he said, what's a tramp freighter? I said, a tramp freighter is a rusty freighter. He says, no, it's not at all. I said, what is it? He says, it's a tramp freighter if it picks up whatever it can take on as cargo and takes it wherever it needs to go and then looks for a new shipment. If it only goes between Bremerhaven and Baltimore every other week, then it's a liner. And if it's not a liner, it's a tramp freighter. I went, I never, you know, one of the other million things I didn't know that led to research that eventually led to a novel.
So the tramp freighter itself, in a way, if all things were being equal, would obviously be transporting war supplies for one side or the other or both.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Secretly. Except for the ones that were kitted out with guns by the Germans and used as raiders, secret raiders. They would come along, they would have the washing on the line, you know, and the guy, the cook peeling potatoes in his undershirt, but it was all a fraud.
When you're working on your other books, including the new one, The Foreign Correspondent, it's pretty obvious you can go to many of the places, and Paris, for example, or Genoa, these are places that are still as they were in many places. However, can you go on board a tramp steamer from those days, a freighter from those days?
Yeah, I had to find one. There's one called the John Y. Brown, which is a former Liberty ship in the harbor in Baltimore. And I went down to Baltimore, and this I almost never do this. But in this case, I absolutely had to go on the freighter because the distances, I didn't understand any of the distances. In other words, how big is the space where the helmsman is standing and the captain standing beside him? How does that actually work? I had to go and see all these things. So I went on this freighter, which is maintained by veterans of the Merchant Marine, and goes out for cruises occasionally. But I didn't go for a cruise. What I did do was go on it and get a sense of it, what it is and how it looks. You know, and you, if you look at the hold of a freighter, everybody knows what I'm saying. Nobody that I'm talking to now on the radio really knows what it looks like. It's five stories down to the bottom. And if you have to go down that little ladder on the side, you are starting at the top of a five-story building and heading for the basement. Not funny. And a lot of people died in those things.
How did you get a sense of what the crew was like and how they interacted?
Oh, there are books about it. I read a bunch of stuff about it. You know, naval history is popular. Naval, shall we say, lore is very popular. And there's a few books about the period, about the Merchant Marine and who they were and how it worked. You can find them. You can find books about everything. I don't look for merchant seamen. I look for books about merchant seamen.
Alan, first, let's talk about your new book, The Foreign Correspondent, which brings you back into a little bit more familiar territory. It takes place just before the start of World War II. There's scenes set in Spain during the Spanish Civil War. Most of the book is set in Paris in 1938 with side trips to Berlin and to Italy. The hero works for Reuters. And let me start there. Reuters seems to have played a very strange role. It's an independent news service, and yet its connection with the British government also existed.
They were all connected to the British government. I use Reuters because it's generic. If you say Reuters, most people go, "Oh, a news service." They don't say it's this, it's that. I couldn't have him writing for a British newspaper. Okay?
Because that would be too obvious.
That would be too apparent. I would suppose that Reuters acted in a patriotic way during when they were threatened by Germany, and I would suppose that all the other wire agencies did as well. As to AP and UPI and INS, you know, at the time, I don't really know. I don't know, but that is what you read.
Our hero, Carlo Weiss, also works for a clandestine newspaper called Liberazione. Now, Italy is under Mussolini's control, and yet a lot of Italians are still anti-fascist and remained anti-fascist through the war. Did Liberazione exist?
Papers like it existed. As I say in the epigraph to the book, there were in fact 512 underground newspapers published and distributed in Italy by the four groups: communists, socialists, liberals, and Catholics. Those were basically the four political divisions. And they all had their own resistance. There was the Catholic resistance, the socialist, the communist, and the liberal. I'm using the liberals in this book as it happens. It was a large organization called Justice and Liberty. And because they were intellectuals and because they had fled their homeland, there they are in Paris. What can they do? Or as it says in the epigraph, fighting fascism with typewriters.
You're combining reality, real Reuters, with a fictional newspaper. I assume that OVRA is real.
Absolutely real.
And that was the organization, the Mussolini's organization that went after groups like...
Yeah, the Italian Gestapo, essentially. Same thing.
Did you use real people outside of, you know, Mussolini and Hitler? For instance, was the head of Reuters, you have a character named Eric Wolf, was he real?
No. The one real guy is Sir Roy Jones, who was in fact the director of Reuters and was famous for discharging a servant because he didn't iron his shoelaces and sending the guy ahead to jump on the pad in the street so the light would change when his car came through, who claimed membership in regiments that he was too short to have joined. He was a real little nightmare. He called himself Sir Roderick Jones, but I think he was born Roy Jones, and he changed it to Roderick because he thought that was Tonya.
Well, again, I'm going to ask you what I asked you before. What was the germ of writing about a Reuters correspondent in France with Italian ties? You've written about a journalist before.
I've written about a journalist before, but this time what happened to me, I knew I wanted to write a book called The Foreign Correspondent. I knew it had to be about a foreign correspondent. It wasn't going to be about an American or a Brit or a Frenchman. And I thought, what does that leave? And then I thought, maybe I'll use an Italian this time, because Italy had a very crucial part in this war. So I start reading Italian history. Lo and behold, I come upon this Italian resistance in Paris that published all these newspapers. I never even heard of it. And I thought, how nice. I get to give my readers some new history. New in the sense that it's not commonly known or talked about. And it's very, very real. And these people lived dangerous lives. But the best thing about them, and it just finally occurred to me to say this last night, at a talk I was giving in Boulder, it's the NPR audience. Honest to God. I looked out at the audience last night and I said, well, these are you. This is you I'm writing about this time. It's all these basically intellectuals in their 40s and 50s, people with glasses. You know what I mean? People, college professors, lawyers, doctors, whatnot. You know, I mean, I thought that's most amazing. And then here they are all of a sudden working as meter readers for the gas company in Paris or driving cabs or teaching languages at Berlitz, trying to survive, and then being attacked by the Italian secret police who had stations in Paris. So it's yet one more different kind of spy novel for me that takes place in a way that maybe isn't in most spy novels, you know.
It's also set during the period of the Pact of Steel between Hitler and Mussolini. I guess you chose that to be the centerpiece.
Yeah, well, that was the end. Yeah. That was really the end. And everybody in Italy, you know, Mussolini started in 1922. Hitler came along and emulated him in 1933. And I most assuredly did not know that when I started reading. But everybody in Italy thought, don't get involved with the Germans. They'll pull us into a war. We can't fight and we can't win. And that's exactly what happened. Mussolini got sucked into it and he signed this pact with Hitler and that was the end of the country. It was destroyed in World War II. It was brutally damaged. It took years to recover. They had a very bad, basically a civil war, much like the one in Greece, although not quite as bad. You know, you can't have a war fought in your country. It's a bad idea. If you can avoid it, by all means, do so.
There are two ideas that circulate. One is the war is inevitable. The other is it can't last. These guys will be overthrown. These two were both very common at the time.
Hopes. You have to remember, reading anything after 1918, how bad World War I was. I don't think people understand how bad of an experience that was. And then you proceed from there. It wrecked the French psychologically. They could not fight the Second World War, and it had to do with the First World War. So their feeling was, these people can't go on. They're going to trip over their feet. They're going to do something wrong, and the army will get rid of them. Well, they did things wrong. They tripped over their feet, and the army never got rid of them. The army tried once or twice, not very hard. But then there was war. Then the people who said there's going to be war were right, and very unfortunate.
And I guess people don't realize that the space between the two wars would be kind of like if World War I ended in 1988, we would be on the verge of World War II today.
That's correct. If World War I ended in 69, you'd be fighting World War II in 89.
Yeah.
That makes it very real for people.
You're listening to an interview with Alan First, whose latest novel is The Foreign Correspondent. You do have characters repeating in these two books, and I don't recall if they repeated before. Character named Kolb, S. Kolb, who's a British spy, and his spymaster, a man named Brown.
Brown goes back to Blood of Victory, but he's fired in mid-Blood of Victory, and another guy is brought in. He doesn't get to keep the dossier. He does return, however, in Dark Voyage and now has working for him S. Kolb. Brown and S. Kolb reappear in The Foreign Correspondent.
Which
after all, it's sold as a spy novel. You should have a spy.
Which takes place 4 years earlier.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Is it hard to keep track of where these people are at particular times?
No. Oh, yes. Where they are, yes. Who they are, no. It's easy for me. I have them all in my head. They live up in there like God knows what. You know, phantoms. I do have to go back and check the books and make sure that I don't get it wrong, that they're available to me in March of 39 and not busy doing something in another book.
I also noticed a cameo by Polanyi.
Yeah, Polanyi's back for a brief cameo at the Brasserie Heininger, where there's a scene set in every book, as well as Andre Schara from the book Dark Star, as well as Fishfang, the screenplay writer from The World at Night. People who are very, very serious fans will be happy to find that scene in there.
Alan, first, as I was reading the scene that took place in Berlin, it's a prelude to war, it's a prelude to fascism. We have seen Kristallnacht occurs during the context of the book. I keep thinking about, where are we today in America? And was that going on in your mind at all when you were writing those scenes?
Sure. These books are resonant, and they're about the struggle between people's rights and government control. And that seems to be a story that's gone on for 2,000 years. These playoffs never end.
America's mainstream press today refuses to cover issues like election fraud, for instance. You'll see it in blogs, that the 2004 election, as well as the 2000 election, could have been stolen. Bush is a liar. He's represented, maybe sometimes negatively, but never as a liar. And I'm wondering how that compares to the way the mainstream press in Europe dealt with Hitler, with Mussolini.
The mainstream press in most countries in Europe was respectful of Mussolini. He was well-liked, very well-liked by the Republican Party in the United States. The American ambassador to Italy wrote his biography, or helped him write his autobiography or something like that. America loved him. Winston Churchill liked him until he started to meddle with the Jews in 1935. Hitler, on the other hand, they never liked. But, you know, one of the very interesting things, and we don't have the time for me to explain it, was the way that the press was controlled and dominated in a fascist country. And it was done, do I have time to say it?
Say it.
It was done in a rather interesting way. The Department of Public Security in Italy went to the owners of the newspapers, great newspapers in Italy. I mean, you're talking about what's the one in Milan? Corriere della Sera. You're talking about serious newspapers that have been there for 100 years. And they said, we don't care who owns the newspaper. We don't care what you write. But we have to have a responsible person to answer to us and to see, you know, based on the truth of what you say. Now then, number one. Number two, they established a doctrine that the obligation of journalism was to support national politics. Came right out that, said that, passed a law, and once the law was passed, it was passed. It was the will of the Italian people. I mean, that's the way they tried to say it, and that's what they tried to get away with. So, of course, they destroyed the newspapers. The owners of Corriere della Sera had to sell it. They sold it to fascists who could live with Mussolini, etc., and so forth. But it wasn't like people marched in there in jackboots and burned it down. I mean, that's happened, too, in certain countries. But it was done in a rather more clever way that wouldn't cause a lot of trouble in the United States, because a lot of these things were played for the audience of the United States, which was the biggest, strongest country, and it would depend whether it stayed neutral and or it came into the war as to whether Hitler and the fascists could win. And they knew that in the 30s.
To American, I don't want to call them fascists, let's call them just right-wingers, it almost seems as if they're trying to take a page from that, just in saying, well, you know, if you disagree with the government, you know, you're a traitor.
You don't like your phone being listened to, what have you got to hide? But you know what? That's like 2,000 years old. The dynamics of authoritarian, totalitarian rule haven't changed. And the moves don't change. It's the technology that changes. The little boxes with the wires in them, that changes. But the way it's explained, the way it's defended, the way a government will reach to control and dominate people, that hasn't changed at all.
And we have fascist propagandists like Ann Coulter today. Was there equivalents to these people in Italy, in Germany? I know in the United States there was Father Coughlin, right?
Yeah, and others. I guess so. You read some of the things that people said, or that she says, in fact, and you wonder that anybody even would bother listening or making such a great stir. But she's got you saying her name here in a studio in Berkeley, California. And in some way or another, That's quite impressive.
It's impressive, but at the same time, it's not as if I'm listening to what she's saying, but I'm watching the effect of people like
her.
Yeah,
no, it's definitely a phenomenon. It's a bandwagon thing. People will jump on. They will say, aha, this is my chance to be famous. These other people at the New York Times, et cetera, they're never going to let me in the door. But here's a bandwagon going through. I'll jump on that. And a lot of what went on in Europe in the 1930s was opportunism. I like to say that the fascism of Italy was opportunism, whereas the fascism of Germany was cruelty. It's very different in those two countries. Those two countries are different, and the right-wing politics of those two countries were extremely different.
There's a comment made that, you know, where somebody says fascism, Mussolini can't last because Italians are not fascists. They're kind of anarchists.
Everybody wanted to believe that. Everybody wanted to believe that, but it wasn't true. And there were a lot of Jews, I should say, who joined the fascist party early on. This is the same situation as Hungary. It's very easy to clarify. They thought they were going to have a serious Bolshevik revolution in 1919. The peasants weren't bringing food to market. There was huge numbers of unemployed. The country started to teeter in that direction. And the next thing is you have Mussolini, the strong man, coming in 1922. He says, no one's going to starve. I'm not going to let the terrible things go on, but we're not going to have communism here either. And on they went, and it's ongoing in Italy. The battle between the two sides continues today. Mussolini's granddaughter is now in the Senate, I think, in Rome, et cetera, and so forth. So it hasn't changed that much.
Can we really learn from history? I mean, I know that you're saying it's 2,000 years. Well, 2,000 years, they're pulling the same crap now in America that we saw 50 years ago in Europe, that we've seen all that go back to Rome. I mean, the question is, can we really learn from it? And if so, what can we do about it?
I think you learn from it, but I also think the impulse is always there in humankind to take care of problems by telling everybody what to do and making them truly, there are people in the world who want you to behave like them. I don't know why. You know, you look at this Christian right and the conservatives, and you look on television, they're going, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do the other thing, two men can't get married, et cetera, and so forth. Why? Why? What's your problem? You want to say to these people, what's your problem? Why are you so interested in this? Why do you even care? Why does it bother you? And there's like a wall between the two sides now. And I don't know what to say about it other than that.
Well, I guess, you know, the problem is when you retreat back into 50 years ago, it's maybe more fun because it doesn't affect you directly. I mean, that may be it. I mean, you can enjoy the spies and the action of World War II because it's distant.
Well, yeah, I guess so. I think, in fact, the entertainment value is watching the kind of the florid side of politics. If you really look at the politics of Germany, it's very boring. I mean, it all happened in a series of small agreements, laws, this, that, and the other. If you look on the spy side, where political contention between three and four different nations, that becomes rather more interesting. And that's always been true. It's true back to Eric Ambler.
Alan, first, you spend a lot of time in Paris, I guess, researching this book, looking for little nooks and crannies. Is that how it kind of worked this time?
Well, I live in Paris part of the time, and I would no matter what I wrote. But when I'm there, sometimes I will find a little leftover remnant of the 1930s or 40s. It's very interesting when you come upon that. It could be a restaurant. It could be a street. It could be really almost anything, because it's sort of hidden here and there. Most of the city's changed. They've cleaned all the buildings. Now they're back to the color that they used to be. Notre Dame is beige.
When you find these places, do you talk to the people in them and try to get the specific histories?
No. I never go at people or go up in their faces like that. I talk to people in Paris in the way that when you live there, you naturally talk to people in the course of life, and that's it. I don't ask questions.
Are you planning to bring Carlo Weiss back?
No, I never do that. I did it once, and I didn't like it.
Okay.
My books work where the lead character always changes. That's always been true. Everybody knows that. I'll never do it again. I did it once because Random House really insisted that I do it with Red Gold. And that book was not meant to have a film producer as a hero. That was my communist resistance book. It should have had a communist as its hero, duh, but it didn't. And that's because they wanted the film producer brought back. I brought him back, and it's about his relations with the French Communist Party. But that might have been a better book had I written it differently.
In the paperback of Dark Voyage, there are study questions in the back of the book.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, I got a telephone call, and they said, would you be willing to work on these? We'll have somebody at Random House write them, but we would like you to help. I said, well, okay. I called my agent, and she said, oh, yes. Oh, yes. She said, we like this very much. I said, why? What is it? She said, it's reading groups all over the place. Some of them 35 to 50 people. You sell 50 copies of a book at once. People have discovered that not only is it fun to read, one way to relate to people is to discuss books. I was in a reading group out where I live, nothing to do with being a writer. I enjoyed reading these books with other people. They were all smart, but they were all different. And they all had a different point of entry to it. Very, very interesting to me. I really enjoyed it.
Have you gotten any feedback from the questions or from the groups themselves?
No, not particularly. Nobody's ever emailed me because I have a website. Nobody's ever emailed me and said, I'm in a book group and we're having this dispute. No, that's never happened.
Are you familiar with a film called Army of Shadows?
I'm familiar with it. I haven't seen it yet. I was in Paris. I couldn't see it. Now I've come back to tour, and I've been on tour since I got back. The minute I get off, I will see that film.
It's a film about the French Resistance, and I saw it when I was in New York a couple of weeks ago. It's stunning. What's interesting about it is they don't really do anything. They're just on the run. And you start to wonder, in fact, in reading your books, most resistance dealt with being on the run.
A lot of it dealt with that, but they did do things. Resistance movements do two things. They harass and they provide intelligence. They do those two things.
When you're looking at Iraq and the, quote, insurgents, do you see any connection there between the resistance movements in Europe from the Iraqis' perspective?
Oh, sure. It's a classical insurgency. It does what insurgencies always do. I was thinking of writing a book about partisans a few years ago, and I started to do the reading, and I decided not to write the book because insurgency and counterinsurgency are extremely ugly. There's reprisal, and that's what there is. It's very, very hard to deal with. It's bad for the army. It's just, in general, very bad. And I don't think that the government really believed that there would be an insurgency. They thought they could occupy without an insurgency. It's very rare. Always there's somebody who doesn't like some soldier standing around at the end of the street. You know, it doesn't have to be a jihadi or anything like that. And the guy happens to have a gun in his bureau. I mean, really.
Alan First, any interest from Hollywood in any of your books?
No. One book is sold. Otherwise, not what I would call any real interest, no. I don't know why. Maybe Army of Shadows will change that.
Alan First, you're working on another one?
I am, but I can't talk about it. I'm not really ready to go to work on it because I don't really have quite a good idea yet.
When you say you're not quite ready, do you have a place and a time yet?
No, I don't have any of that.
Really?
I'm in quite early stages. I'm still thinking about what I want to do for the next book, but I do have some ideas. But they're very – I had some ideas 3 weeks ago, and they were wrong. So
when you say they're wrong, what does that mean?
That means I don't want to do them. it means that I don't actually like them. I think I like them, but I don't actually like them.
So what is the first, very, very first step? Okay, you've got a vague – let's pick one, Greece. Okay, I'm going to write about Greece in 1939, let's say. What do you do then?
Well, that might not necessarily be true. I might say – I want to write about royalty, and I want to write about good kings. Where can I find myself a good king? Well, I happen to know there was a good king in Greece. So I go, oh, I'll write a Greek novel. Now, how will I do that? You know, and then I start thinking about it in that way. The ideas come from different places. They don't always come from a place, although I do think about that for a new book. Where would I like to start it? Because where you start it matters a lot, because where you start it also determines the time frame.
Then at that point, you can go into your almanacs and charts and say,
oh, then I know everything. You know, I don't even have to go into the almanacs. I know the history very well, and I know about what happened, and I know about what kind of characters would be generated by that history.
One thing that really intrigued me in this book, and if I were to say I would like to see more of it, is there's a bit about the German resistance. And we don't know much about the German resistance to the Nazis.
Well, there are a lot of books about it, but there wasn't very much of it. I wrote a little bit about it this time. I may write some more about it, about the one group that really resisted. I read some pretty good books about it. It's pretty interesting. Of course, they all died. I mean, everybody that tried to oppose Hitler did, pretty much. The British and American spy services did have one or two people in there that survived, that got out through Switzerland. But basically, to resist Hitler was to lose your life.
There's a sequence when our hero, Carlo Weiss, goes to Italy, and then he leaves. He's trying to set up printing presses down there, and then he leaves. And the book eventually will end with him, but what happens to the printing presses? And there's a point where he says, well, and this is going on in his mind, these people are going to lose their lives at some point, and this whole system is going to come crashing down. And I guess that's pretty much what would happen.
Of course. With those kinds of things, you say, we're going to have this for 8 weeks. You don't tell the people doing it that you have 8 weeks to live. But if you're operating it and you're stimulating it and you're using it to fight, you know that it can last between 8 and 12 weeks. That's how long the last 10 lasted.
Alan, first, it seems like if you've gained any knowledge yourself about this, it's that on some level the human condition just doesn't change.
Doesn't seem to. Let's say that the human condition requires us, it would seem, to try to keep it nice as much as we can, because there's a tendency to curve off down into the lower depths all the time. I don't know how to put it any better than that. No one is saying, really, that our species is the greatest species in the world. It may not be a good species at the end, and it may not survive.
You've been listening to an interview with Alan Furst, whose latest novel is The Foreign Correspondent. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.